Welcome to Parents' Perspective. It was nearly time to catch the bus, but 8-year-old Donnie was still up in his room. His dad bounded up the stairs and poked his head in the door. "Come on, fella, get a move on. You don't want to be late for your first day of third grade." "Aw," came from somewhere in Donnie's closet. "I think Tim took my best Mac action guy and didn't give it back. Now what'll I take?"
"Hey, buddy, what about that cool pencil case your mom got? It's here in your old G.I. Joe backpack."
Donnie was now tossing things over his shoulder, making a debris pile of toys and shoes on the floor around the closet.
"That case is dumb. Nobody uses those anymore."
He stuck his head out of the closet briefly.
"She probably made me dumb old peanut butter and jelly. Nobody ever trades anything for that."
"Hey, come on, buck up. It's your first day. How bad can things be?"
"Bad? I bet I'll have mean old Mrs. Miller. She probably won't even let us have trading."
From a parent's perspective, what should we know as our children begin a new school year? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. We're fortunate to have an expert on this subject joining us today. Chris Twait is the lower school head of the Langley School, a private nonsectarian school grades pre-K through 8 in McLean, Virginia. Having worked in international schools in a variety of countries, Chris is now an international educational consultant with Children's Resources International, a Washington-based foundation. Children's Resources International works in partnership with the U.S. Agency for International Development to set up a program called Democracy in Schools. Democracy in Schools promotes child-centered education in primary schools in 30 different countries. Chris is also the godmother of 4 wonderful children. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Chris.
Thank you, and I'm delighted to be here today.
As children return to school each fall, what kinds of anxieties do you see them having?
I think often the transition of coming into a new school year and a new class, trying to form friendships, can be challenging for children of all ages. I think one of the greatest roles we can give children in terms of adults, whether we're parents or teachers or administrators in schools, is being very calm and being very caring, and I think being consistently supportive of a child's needs.
What should parents keep in mind to play that role when they're preparing for a new school year?
I think the most important thing that a parent can keep in mind is that we honor and they realize that they are really a child's first educator. And I think that they need to give an impression of consistency and calmness when children are making transitions into a new school year, and to always be very supportive and sort of optimistic about the benefits and the opportunities that are going to happen in September when you start again.
So when a child begins agonizing about this or that, what should a parent do?
I think it's very important that a parent is a very, very good listener. They are actively listening to a child, that they're really probing a child's questions, and that they try to support the child's thoughts and saying, well, you know, for example, I remember I had a young child in my office last week who said that his parent brought him to visit school because he's starting first grade. And he said to me, he said, "Oh, well, you know, Mrs. Twait, I'm not sure about coming to the big school." And I said, "Well, you know, George, it's going to be really fun. And would you like to see your room?" And I said, "I'm sure your mother would like to see your room. Your father would like to see the room." And we tried to show him the room, and we showed him around, and we talked about what some of his concerns were in terms of coming to a bigger building and a routine and new friends and things of that sort.
And it was okay to have those concerns. Obviously, you guys made it okay for him.
I think it's wonderfully okay. And I think, again, it's very important that a child knows that it's okay to to have those opinions and to express them, and that he has adults, whether they're parents or teachers or other family members, who are really actively listening and communicating their support for the child.
How do we let children know we're actively listening?
I think one of the simplest things to do is, first of all, to always have good eye contact with children. And I think we very often forget that a young child is often at our waist level. Years ago, I was teaching first grade, and a little boy came up to me, and he was talking away, and I didn't bend down and make eye contact with him. And I was saying something, and he pulled at my waist, and he said, "You know, Mrs. Twait, you've got a wonderful belt on today." And that immediately told me that he really wasn't listening to what I was saying. He was just looking at my middle. I think the whole notion, yeah, exactly. The whole notion of making eye contact with a child is very, very important. I think it's also very important to hug a child. I think it's very important that a child is comfortable with physical contact. There are lots of ways of communicating with children.
What kinds of activities, both in school and out, can help students make a smooth transition back into their school year?
I think probably one of the most helpful things parents can do is to establish some sort of a good daily routine, maybe 2 or 3 weeks before the school is starting, so that they're practicing, you know, going to bed at a reasonable hour. They establish some sort of parameters for watching television, for having dinner together, again, for having an active family dialogue about school starting, and so that they, you know, practice getting up in the morning, practice the idea of getting a backpack ready, getting a lunch ready, figuring out if you're going out to catch a bus or catch a carpool or you're going to walk to your neighborhood school, so that you're sort of eased into that routine, so that it's not sort of a shock the next day you suddenly have to change a routine that you've had for the last 8 or 9 weeks and jump into something totally different.
Is there any way to help them prepare for the fact that they're going to come home from school sometimes with things they have to do at night, whether it's regular homework or pull together something for a project the next day, or that just happens when school opens?
Yeah, I'm a sort of a very big believer in children pursuing what I like to call summer projects. I think children, whether they're doing summer schools or summer camps or summer activities, I think one of the greatest learning opportunities that parents can give children is to give them the opportunity to work on a project over the summer. And whether it's a child of 6 or a child of 12, to really develop a passion for something like dinosaurs or learning about how airplanes fly or learning about how to take care of horses and doing all sorts of research, whether it's on the internet or it's by reading books or it's by actually going out and taking care of a horse, and letting the child really keep that sort of project-based learning going the whole summer. And try to involve different learning tools. I mean, whether it's keeping a journal, you know, actively going to a library and reading, or doing a lot of experience-based learning. I think in that way, you sort of keep the thread of somewhat of a structured learning environment going without sort of overloading a child.
We had someone suggest to us, a mother actually suggested, that even when her children were very, very young, she had them do journals all summer, and those who couldn't write drew a picture every day of something from that day. And she says they're priceless now that the children are grown up.
Yeah, it's a wonderful notion to keep a summer journal, you know, whether it's related to reading or experiences or travels or just daily activities. I think it's also a wonderful thing because it validates a child's sort of learning experience, mm-hmm. and it gives them something concrete to share with other children. It gives them something to bring into school the first day and share with their friends and share with their new teacher. I think it just celebrates the whole idea of a child publishing their success and publishing their learning experience.
It would seem like a follow-up to that might be that at the end of every week on a Friday night or whenever, at dinner, a child might be able to share what he or she has done on his summer project during the week.
It's a great idea, and I think it's a great idea of building the notion of community within a family, too, and the notion of siblings learning to respect what their brothers or sisters may be doing or have discovered that week if they were doing a project on insects or backyard animals or whatever. I think it's a wonderful notion.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on beginning a new school year.
Two excellent books written by hosts Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, are available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Chris Twait, lower school head of the Langley School, about helping our children begin a new school year.
Remember we talked with someone one time about every night at dinner, when we did a program on families having dinner together, but the suggestion was everyone in the family had to tell three things that happened that day, and they couldn't be, I went to gym, I ate lunch, and I tied my shoes or something. It had to be a little more interesting. I loved that. My children were grown-ups. It was a little too late for me to start imposing that, but I think that's a great idea.
It is very important, and I think the other thing it does is it really enhances a child's ability to communicate. And I think communication skills are one of the things in schools that we are discovering more and more are needed, and that we need to give children opportunities to develop communication skills. And I think one of the ways that you do that is by having a very active partnership between the parents and the school and sharing, you know, those sorts of activities and those sorts of ideas.
Mm-hmm. So that when the child enters school, the teacher can know that during the entire summer he's been researching dinosaurs.
Exactly, exactly. In many of the schools where I taught, I often had interviews with each family before the school year, and the parents would tell me about their goals and objectives for the child for the year, and we would talk about some of the ideas or some of the projects they may have worked on over the summer or some of the passions that the parents would observe their child as having. And again, it just builds that sort of a partnership.
The other thing that's interesting I'm thinking about with the project idea is that it gives a child his or her first taste of delayed gratification.
Yeah.
Because you have to have steps and it can't all be done at once and so on and so forth. And then you get to a point down the line where there's an actual fruition of the whole thing.
Right. You have a product and it's celebrated. And, you know, very often parents can celebrate it by having a special meal or can celebrate it by giving a child maybe something that's connected to the project as a reward. It's a very gratifying experience for a child. And young children often bring me their summer projects or their journals and share them with me. And there's no greater joy that they have than sharing something that they've done themselves.
Now I can just imagine all the parents out there listening. A lot of them will be saying, well, I don't know. What kind of project could we give our kid? Oh, dear. I don't know what he's interested in. Can you suggest some things that kids would love to do during the summer?
Well, I actually think that probably some of the best source of information in terms of what a child would be interested in is the child themselves. And I think that, again, goes back to the communication and the listening. Because I think when you listen carefully to a young child, they will pretty clearly tell you things they're interested in, or you can sort of, you know, ask them, well, would you like to do maybe a project about dogs, or are you interested in dinosaurs, or are you interested in cooking? I once had a little boy when I was teaching at a school in Berlin who was passionately interested in cooking. And he spent the summer collecting recipes and making a little cookbook and drawing little journals and pictures of how he would make this and how he learned how to make Wiener Schnitzel and how he'd made this one and that one. And it was a fascinating children's cookbook by the time he'd finished the summer. So.
And does he have a restaurant that we could go to?
I wish I knew that, actually.
It's interesting. One of the things that I think of when I think of summer projects is I think kids are, of course, I had only boys, but kids who were interested in all the creepy things that come out in the summertime, bugs and insects and animals and that kind of thing. And one of the things that occurred to me is in a lot of communities, there are nature centers that parents can take advantage of. There are very often programs where kids can go and start there.
They're wonderful opportunities. I think in all of our communities, we're very, very blessed. There are wonderful opportunities for learning, whether it's a community-based center or parks or just even a simple neighborhood park. And
we've talked a little bit about projects in the summer, but I guess we need to talk about the concept of downtime. There are such mixed feelings in our society about downtime. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Do kids lose their skills? You know, what should be done? How do you feel about the whole concept of downtime during the summer?
I'm a very big advocate of downtime during the summer. I often remember the analogy that I was taught when I was going to graduate school, and I had a wonderful professor by the name of Vivian Paley. She was a guest professor, and she taught kindergarten at the University of Chicago's Lab School for about 30 years, and she's now about 80 years old, and she has this absolutely fabulous analogy, and she said that a child's brain is not like a sponge. You can't just keep pouring more water in and expect it to get absorbed at a continual rate. And it's a very simple analogy, but I think it's true. I think children need downtime. I think they need time that isn't structured. I don't think that that means that that's not learning time. In many respects, I think it's wonderful learning time because a child is making their own discoveries. A child is discovering connections and building upon their prior learning. One of the things that I think is very important to do with children during the summer, no matter if you have a child that's 4 or 3 or 12, is to continue to read to them and to continue to build a passion for reading and listening and having a really active dialogue about literature. And I think the summer allows you to do that in a much less structured way than you probably have during the school year.
This is a time for kids to be creative and be able to write their own stories.
Right, exactly. Or to discover new authors that they didn't know before. I think we're extremely blessed in this country to have extraordinary public libraries. And I think we should use them to the fullest capacity we can. Librarians are great sources of ideas for young children. Just the notion of a child going to a library and just browsing freely and choosing books that maybe they know nothing about, I think is fabulous. Choosing books they can't read. And then having a dialogue as a parent with them about the materials or about the pictures or about the content.
What about summer school? When kids go to summer school for academic subjects, is there a difference in their adaptation in the fall to re-entering school?
I suppose that would depend upon, you know, the reason for going to summer school. I think there are a lot of wonderful summer programs out there and summer schools that perhaps offer children learning opportunities that they maybe wouldn't have within the framework of a traditional school year, in terms of maybe offering them curricular areas that their school doesn't offer. And I think that's fabulous. And I think in some cases, although I think they're probably rather rare, there are children who need to go to summer school for academic reasons and enrichment and things of that sort. I don't see a huge difference in a child coming back to our school after they've been in a more academic program in the summer than those that have had sort of more downtime and exploration time. I think it's very individualistic, and it depends upon the needs of a child.
A variation on the activity.
Yeah, and maybe just a variation of, I mean, I can think of examples where we've asked parents to do some work maybe with phonographics or beginning reading skills or things like that, and maybe encouraged a child to do a 4-week course of that over the summer to sort of supplement some of their skills and bring their reading levels along. But I think by and large, those sorts of structured experiences should really be limited to a part of the summer.
All the parents out there can take a huge sigh of relief. Now we can make our vacation plans.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on beginning a new school year.
For an audio cassette copy of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Chris Twait, lower school head of the Langley School, about helping our children begin a new school year.
Are there re-entry issues that are different for different age groups?
Yes, I think enormously different for different age groups because it depends on the developmental level of the child. I think it also depends to some degree on the anxiety level of the parent. I think for many parents, kindergarten and first grade is a very big transition, not just for a child, but for a parent. I think that you probably have somewhat the same transition anxieties or concerns for first, second, and third grade. And then I think you go into a different developmental level where the peers tend to become more of an active concern for children entering fourth and fifth grade and what sort of a mix they're going to get into and how that's going to work and, you know, how they're going to deal with different friends and remixing children every year and all of that.
The whole social element
right.
gets a little stronger.
The social element gets a little stronger. And it's a very interesting notion that America is still one of the only countries in the world that actively mixes children up into new classes every year. Many of the European countries tend to keep children in the same class, in the same social group for 3 or 4 years in a row. And their feeling is that it offers children more social stability and less challenges in terms of transitioning.
How have you seen the contrast between those two systems?
Well, having taught in a German system where I had the same class from kindergarten through third grade, I was extraordinarily skeptical of it when it started. And I thought it was a rather unusual notion that I would keep those children for 4 years. But I learned to become a very big advocate of it because I think it does lessen the transition and the transition anxieties that some children experience. It also allows you to build a wonderful relationship with 20 parents and 20 families, mm-hmm. and you keep that intact for 3 or 4 years. And I think that's very beneficial. It also may help a lot of our children because I think a lot of children in the States have a lot of demands put upon their times and are dealing with lots of different people during their day. I mean, they're not just dealing with parents in school. They're dealing with a ballet teacher and they're dealing with a violin teacher and they're dealing with all sorts of other transitions during the day. So I think in many respects we're asking children to deal with a great deal of new faces and new social settings.
Chris, how can teachers help their students ease back into the academic setting when they get there in the fall?
Well, I think one of the most beneficial things that teachers and schools in general can do is having some sort of a visiting day before the actual school year starts. I think that helps a great deal, and it doesn't have to be a long session. At Langley, we do it for about an hour and a half, 2 days before school starts, and all the children are invited to come and visit their new classrooms, visit the teacher. I think it's very important that from a standpoint of what a teacher can do, is that a teacher is very warm and very welcoming, that a teacher has a lot of time to talk to children during the first couple weeks of school, that she makes a special point of greeting children every morning, of shaking their hand, of listening to them. And I also think it's very important during the first couple weeks of school that a teacher and a school as an institution does something which we like to call shaking a child out, that at the end of the day, we shake each child's hand, we look at them, we talk about something that they've done that day that we're really very fond of. And I think that makes children feel very comfortable and very secure in their new class situation.
There are schools that I have seen where the head of the school or the head of one part of the school stands at the school door and shakes the child's hand going in. But mm-hmm. this is interesting because this basically says that you're proud of what the child has accomplished during his job
right.
at school that day.
Right. As we do that, I meet all of the children every morning in the foyer of the lower school, and I always greet them by name and try to have some sort of comment for them. And then the other side of that is a parent honoring that by also very often bringing the child in and saying, oh, how nice it is to see you. And they see that the child is part of that community. And then the teacher does that at the end of the day to explain that we value them and we value them being part of our community. I think that does a great deal to teaching children that they are citizens and that they do belong to a community and that the school is more than an academic experience, that it is in fact a place where people respect each other and have responsibilities, but a place where we also care very deeply about one another.
And it empowers the child to think that he's doing a part of what needs to be done to keep that community prospering.
Of course, and it really gives the child a feeling that they're valuable and that we notice them, even though in my division I have 220 children. But it's very important that they know that and that they have that sense of what a lot of people are writing about these days they call connectiveness, that we're connected to something, that we have some sort of a bond with the people that we spend a great deal of our days with.
Well, you have certainly helped us with our bond with the people who we spend a good deal of our days with as parents. Do you have resources that you would suggest?
for parents.
I think there are many wonderful local parent magazines that are published that have some great sort of timely topics in them, no matter what region of the country you live in. I also would highly recommend any of Vivian Paley's books that I mentioned earlier. She's written 5 or 6 books that are in some respects aimed at educators, but are also wonderful books for parents to read. One of them that I'm very fond of is called The Kindness of Children. And it really lets you look at children and discover their wonderful sense of kindness and graciousness to one another. It also helps you to build that sense in your own child. Another author that I'm very fond of and who's very well known these days is Michael Thompson. And he's written Raising Cain. He's a very well-known psychologist. He has a new book out called Best Friends, Worst Enemies, which I think is a marvelous introduction to parents in terms of understanding sort of social development and social behavior of children, and that sort of dichotomy of children when they have a best friend and the next day the best friend is the worst enemy. And it's a very readable book. And it's also a great book to use in book clubs or book circles to discuss with other parents. Another very good source of materials is the American Library Association has a wonderful website where they give you topics. If you were a parent going in and you were concerned about, you know, the idea of transitioning to a new school year, they would give you a great list of books that have to do with children entering a new school year, children moving and having to make the transition to a new school. And again, your local library, I think, is a good source of information.
What's the website for American Library?
I believe it's ALA.org, which stands for the American Library Association.org.
Well, our special thanks to Chris Twait for helping us better understand our children's needs at the beginning of a new school year and our parents' needs as well. We're so glad you could join us.
Well, I'm delighted to join you, and I think you've done a wonderful effort by offering this opportunity to parents to widen their perspective.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show number 157. Tell us what station you're listening to if you can, since we're airing all over the world. It's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids are both available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our books Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from Sandy Spring National Bank and Bonneville International Corporation. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.